The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Good morning. Good afternoon. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. This is News Dissector Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network.com. The show is being pre-recorded by an hour or two, but it will be available in the archives on the Progressive Radio Network.com site later today. I'll also be posting it on my blog probably, so you'll be able to see and hear it anyway, if not see it. So I'm going to be talking today with some people I really admire, including Max Wolf, The Economist, including Nancy Corbo, who's doing some great work organizing people in California. But we'll be starting with an old friend and a wise person, a person who I've learned so much from, the author Chris Hedges. And Chris will be on with me in a moment. You're listening to News Dissector Radio.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo.
Okay, here we go. My first guest, Chris Hedges. Now, I first met Chris in Boston many, many years ago. He was at the Harvard Divinity School, a journalist who was also interested in the issues of faith and theology, and became interested and involved in covering Latin America. He moved and covered the Contra War, and I ran into him some years later in El Salvador, where he was covering El Salvador for the Christian Science Monitor, one of the, I thought, best correspondents there, offering not only news but analysis and background. And then through the fates of journalism and because his work was recognized, he moved up, if it is moving up, into the arms of the New York Times. And Chris, as a correspondent, covered the Middle East, covered wars, covered conflicts all over the world, and has now phased out, you know, of writing daily journalism. He's become an author of really a best-selling and provocative books, important books, and he's also lecturing all over the place. I really can't keep up with him, but I know it's because his work really strikes a chord with so many people. So joining me also, Sherry Welch, our dissectress. Are you there, Sherry?
Good morning, Danny. Good afternoon, Danny.
Okay, from Atlanta. And Chris, so happy that you could spare some time this morning to be with us.
Thanks, Danny.
So tell us a little bit, before we get into the new book and your argument about the liberalism and how it's sort of kind of wimped out and no longer relevant in any way, your own kind of path to this. I mean, you started off, if not as a liberal, certainly as somebody who believed in the power of journalism. You were a correspondent. Take us through your career a little bit so that people can appreciate where you're coming from.
Well, I'm certainly a product of the liberal institutions I critique, including the church where I grew up. My father was a minister. I spent 8 years in a university, quite a feat, considering that I never earned a doctorate. And was a member of a union. I was guild when I was at the New York Times. And the New York Times, in many ways, is sort of the premier liberal news organization in the country. So on the one hand, I owe a great deal to these institutions. On the other hand, I was always deeply critical and often very alienated from them. I walked out on the church. When I was a seminarian at Harvard, I lived in Roxbury, which you know well, Mission Main, across the street from the Mission Main Mission Extension Housing Project, and ran a church there, and really began to have a rupture with the liberal church, which had left the inner city with white flight. These liberal Christians who like the poor but don't like the smell of the poor. I chose the type of journalism I did. I consciously went to Latin America in the early 1980s because of the dirty war in Argentina, because of Pinochet in Chile, because of Rios Montt in Guatemala, because of the death squads in El Salvador that were killing, when I got there, between 700 and 1,000 people a month. So it wasn't a career I was necessarily seeking. Beginning as a freelance reporter is often a pretty bad way to build a career in mainstream organizations. And indeed, while covering the war in El Salvador, I was offered a staff job by the Washington Post. But they said I'd have to come back to suburban Washington and be groomed. And of course, I refused. So the career was never the point. I volunteered to go into Sarajevo in 1994, went in there in 95. And as the editor of the New York Times, Joe Lelyveld, told me, I guess the line starts and ends with you. These were situations that I threw myself into. And by the time I came back to the United States after some 20 years of by choice, covering some of the worst conflicts around the globe, because I wanted to give a voice and write about the plight of those people who were being crushed, often with direct support and acquiescence of my own government, certainly in the case in Gaza, then I ran into real trouble, because that kind of independence and that kind of worldview was very unacceptable within the corporate confines of the New York Times, and it was just a matter of time until I was very outspoken against the Iraq War, and which made the paper increasingly uncomfortable, and then a very high-profile commencement address saw me booed off the stage at Rockford College.
I remember that.
And the paper was forced, their hand was forced, by Fox and all these other trash talk shows who wanted to know what they were going to do about it, and they issued me a written reprimand, which is the process in when you're unionized, you give the employee a formal warning, and then the next time they violate it, in my case, the next time I spoke out against the war, I'd be fired. So I left the paper after that.
So let's go back. I existed
within those institutions, but it was often a very uncomfortable relationship.
Let's go back a second, because I identify with this. You know, I worked in some of this period. I was working for ABC News on the inside after having dissected news at WBCN in Boston, where I had really something that was really rare for journalists in broadcasting, that is editorial freedom.
Right.
I pretty much could do what I was interested in reporting, and the audience seemed to like it, you know.
Because, Danny, as you know better than I, there's a huge difference between truth and news. One can write a report that is, at least in the jargonese of American journalism, balanced and factually accurate, but untrue. And I think there's a deep cynicism in the part of American journalism, especially now commercial broadcast journalism, where you bring in one lying publicist or spin consultant on one side and one on another, and essentially you're telling people they can believe whatever they want to believe. And that loss of a kind of moral center, which is more pronounced on the airwaves, but it's not absent at all from newsprint, I think is alienated, and correctly alienated, large segments of the population who see these organizations for what they are. They're elitist, they define successful journalism by access to the power elite, not by ferreting out truth. And that's why the New York Times sold us all the lies that were used to justify the invasion of Iraq. It's why this huge business section at the New York Times utterly missed the financial meltdown, because they were running down to Wall Street or Goldman Sachs or Citibank to have lunch with Robert Rubin or somebody, instead of going out to poor neighborhoods where mortgage brokers and bankers were filling out fraudulent forms to shove loans down the throats of people they knew could never repay them.
I think part of the reason that you develop eyes that can see beneath this and beyond it, this has to do to some degree with life experience. I know that for a time, and this is a minor kind of footnote in your career, you were a member of the Greater Boston YMCA boxing team. True?
Yes,
and you fought in various neighborhoods like Charlestown, working class communities, and got a feeling of not just being within the Harvard elite, but among the people in Boston. I had that experience too. too. I also grew up in a housing project in the Bronx. My dad was a garment worker in the union. And I think that helped shape my view, my inside, let's say, BS detector. But when you work in big media, you have to navigate this minefield. And you can't always be honest with the people you're working with for fear that somehow your stories will be, you know, hatcheted in some way. And you know, I had that experience at ABC News. You were in El Salvador covering the war, and I have one story to tell about that in a second. But when I came back covering the way the AID, the Agency for International Development, was promoting, birth control in that country with forced methodologies and laparoscopic, I can never pronounce the word, but, you know, basically forcing women into procedures that would never allow them to have children again. And when I came back to New York after we met in El Salvador, my story was killed, okay, without even being looked at. And it was killed because, quote, we had done El Salvador. Actually, we had done a story about the asylum debate about El Salvador refugees coming to the United States. And there was a story of a church, I think, in Arizona that was providing some sort of help to these people. And that somehow communicated itself to the executives at ABC as if, okay, we've done that story, let's move on, even though the two stories had nothing really in common. So I remember that. And I also remember one little incident to me that was very telling. You may not remember this, Chris, but it's about the power of observation. When we were in San Salvador, we went to a Chinese restaurant. I don't know if you remember that. And this, you wrote about this restaurant. This was a guy who had been in China having a restaurant. And then suddenly the Chinese civil war broke out. Chiang Kai-shek, Mao Zedong, he decided this is getting too violent. He decided, let me find another place to move to. So he spun the globe and he ended up in Vietnam. And soon thereafter, the Vietnam War followed. He had the same experience. I've got to get out of here. Took the globe again, spun it, ended up in El Salvador, where we met him, and of course, where the war followed. And, you know, your power of observation about this one little story spoke to me volumes about what's missing in our media, how to connect the experiences of ordinary people with these great world events, and how they interact with these events, and how they become in some ways victimized by them and central to them. And I think that this is part of what's missing. Also, the way we essentially reduce things to slogans as if they're really descriptive of what's really happening.
Well, it's all about vision. Anybody who came back from a place like Bosnia or El Salvador to the newsroom, as I did, had to be very careful to hide their feelings about what was happening. Now, let's remember that these were killing grounds. We were talking hundreds, thousands of people, including children, being butchered. But if you, in front of your editors, expressed any kind of emotion, all the antennas went up and they would remove you from covering that. And so we all played this kind of game. And most reporters, even at the New York Times, go into this not for the money. There is a deep kind of idealism there. They don't write for the publisher or even for their editors, most of whom they despise, but for the reader. And the reporters, the good reporters who remain faithful to their reader, often run into tremendous problems, and they get sidelined in their careers. And David K. Johnson is a perfect example of that. There is a kind of conflict between the people who manage these institutions. These are Fortune 500 companies who are seeking not to disenfranchise or anger their advertiser and the elite readers or viewers that they seek to reach, and those reporters who struggle. So it's working at the New York Times is a very unpleasant experience. It's a fear-driven environment, a tremendous amount of anxiety. I mean, I literally knew good reporters who would go in there, and the first thing when they got in the building, they'd go to the bathroom and throw up. And then try and go through their day's work.
And some of them just couldn't wait to get out of there. I mean, Johnny Kiffner, who covered the civil rights movement really brilliantly in the 60s and covered the student activism in that period, became, one of your colleagues. And
yeah.
He also spoke to me about his, disconnect personally with the culture there, with the identification with the elite, with the condescension to the public and to the readers even.
He stuck it out longer than I did. But, Kiff is like that. And, you know, you talk about remaining honest. It wasn't just Roxbury, but half of my family is very poor, working class from Maine. And I got a scholarship to go to boarding school when I was 10, so I had this weird kind of childhood where I was surrounded by the super rich and yet never forgot where I came from. And I think that informed my journalism, that I understood the hypocrisy, when George Bush became president, I smelled him out immediately. I'd gone to prep school with a million George Bushes. I knew exactly the type, the kind of sense of entitlement, the arrogance, the callousness, and the difference really comes down to when you're working class or poor, you don't get a second chance. People like Bush gets chance after chance after chance.
Interesting, isn't it? Interesting, isn't it, Chris, how in the packaging of this new book of his, the whole focus on is really, yes, he deals with, quote, some issues, but he's depoliticized. He's suddenly reborn as a sensitive person who was fighting alcoholism. This was the story that NBC Nightly News ran with, a clip from Matt Lauer's interview. The only good news about that interview was that the ratings were terrible, and people preferred watching Dancing with the Stars by a large number. But, I just saw this as an attempt to make this, you know, kind of, in a sense, make Bush this person that, you know, we could really adore. Even Maureen Dowd said in reading this book, I figured, well, this is a kind of guy I could vote for, until, you know, she was, of course, reminded or never forgot what he actually did in office. Sherry, what do you think of Chris's, discussion here this morning? It's really talking to me deeply and hopefully to our listeners.
I wish we had a dozen Chris Hedges to your columns on Truthdig. And I want you to talk a little bit, now that Obama's being urged by Democrats to pull to the center. This ties in with your book, Death of the Liberal Class. Chris, can you comment on that?
Well, Obama has never been anywhere near the center. The Democratic Party in Europe would be considered a far-right party.
Mm-hmm.
Obama, and I didn't, you know, in all candor, I did not support Obama in 2008. I voted for Nader. I, in fact, wrote several of his speeches.
Good for you.
Obama functioned as a brand, and a very successful one, which is why Advertising Age, after the campaign, gave them their top annual award, Marketer of the Year. It Bennington and Calvin Klein did a very similar thing a few years before, where they used people of color and HIV positive models to give their products an edge, to associate their products with risque style. And that's really what Obama was, and how Obama functioned. Which is why his largest bundlers were Goldman Sachs. It's why he was able to rake in far more corporate money than the Republicans. And what we've seen over the last 2 years is a craven service of corporate interests at the expense of the American people. It's worse than at the expense, at the impoverishment and further forms of disempowerment. What Obama did tragically is codify the destruction of domestic and international law, including the removal of habeas corpus put in place by the Bush administration. But what's fascinating about the midterms is that I think what we're seeing is that the corporate state, these corporate entities who at this point have carried out a kind of coup d'etat in slow motion, are crumpling up Obama and throwing him away. And there's a kind of Greek or maybe even Faustian quality to this, where I think Obama really, who should have known better, sold his soul to these people, and now these people are discarding him.
You know, you've also written, Chris, you said, here we are again begging Obama to be Obama. He is Obama. Obama is not the problem. We are. What do you mean by that?
Well, we forgot that we have to hold fast to certain moral imperatives, even if, as Ralph said after the election, he felt like it was me, him, and Patty Smith. That's not bad company. I think we have to hold fast to these moral imperatives. That's a change. The true correctives to American democracy never came from those who exercised formal positions of power. Whether it was the Liberty Party fighting slavery, the suffragists, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, you know, Karl Popper in The Open Society and Its Enemies writes that the question is not how do you get good people to rule. That's the wrong question. The question is how do you stop those in power from doing as much damage as possible. And Popper writes, I think correctly, that most people who are attracted to power are at best mediocre, which is Obama, or venal, which is Bush. And we, in who care about the protection of our democracy, of equality, of traditional liberal values, forgot this. And we threw our lot in with a Democratic Party that since the Clinton administration has made war on the working class. And much of the rage that we're now seeing expressed towards Washington, it's very cleverly channeled towards government and away from Wall Street, but much of that rage I think all of that rage is legitimate, and yet the liberal establishment, which no longer supports core liberal values, but traditional liberal institutions, whether the press, the church, Democratic Party, labor, still speaks in this kind of bloodless language of policies and issues. Now, the danger of the breakdown of the liberal class is that the liberal institutions and a liberal class provides a channel or a mechanism or a safety valve by which the grievances and sufferings of citizens can be redressed through piecemeal or incremental reform. We saw that in the 1930s with the collapse of capitalism and the New Deal. We saw it again with the civil rights movement. Now that mechanism is broken. We live in what the philosopher Sheldon Wolin calls a system of inverted totalitarianism, meaning that unlike classical totalitarianism, we haven't had a revolutionary radical party sweep away decaying structures. We've seen the rise of the corporate state that purports to pay fealty to electoral politics and the legislative process and the Constitution, but has taken over the levers of powers to render the citizens impotent. And in that system, the Democrats have been completely complicitous for money, of course, and that was Clinton's strategy to get and by the 90s, he did. He got he had fundraising parity with the Republicans, but the price of that was NAFTA, gutting of welfare, the deregulation of the banking system, courtesy of Larry Summers, who Obama brought back in to serve corporate interests, and at its core, the betrayal of working men and women.
Well, interesting,
and we forgot that.
Interesting, isn't it, that Obama took this program, this Larry Summers, Tim Geithner special, out to Asia, to South Korea, for the G20 meeting, and it was roundly rejected.
Well, of course it was.
By everybody in the world, basically, you know, both the right and the left, and if there is a left, I mean, certainly by, you know, Brazil, certainly by China, certainly by even Germany, you know. Looks like there's no place to go anymore. I mean, that this liberal center is in the process of implosion. The media certainly is degraded far more than, you know, even we, you know, who railed against it expected. I mean, just a consistent decline in media coverage. And, you know, I'm at least your books seem to be finding an audience, and I really, you know, believe in them. I think it's really important. I wish you all the best with this effort to promote the book and to promote the ideas that underlie it. You know, you're blogging for Truth Dig, is that right?
Yeah, I have a column every Monday. This is Bob Shear's website out of L.A.
Right, so Bob.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
What do you suggest that we do, Chris?
All resistance is local. The coup is over. They won. We lost. And it's we've got to build sustainable communities, especially around the issue of food, because as things get worse, the corporate state isn't going to take care of us. The rise of the corporate state always brings with it the rise of the security and surveillance state. So the response is that we have to begin to prepare to sustain ourselves. I just did an article this week in The Nation on Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the country, not surprisingly the most dangerous. There's no supermarket in the center of Camden. It's a food desert. People eat fried chicken and donuts. It's grease and fat. And because poor people can't buy tomatoes that are shipped across country from California. And these post-industrial pockets are going to become larger and larger as we enter an age of neo-feudalism. And we can't be passive.
People can read this in The Nation this week. Thanks again, Chris, for being with us today. It really kind of energizes me because your voice is a voice of great clarity and great inspiration to many people. I hope we'll stay kind of in connection with each other and continue to, you know, share this battle, this fight that really needs to be waged right now. Chris Hedges, everybody, thank you for being on News Dissector Radio.
Thanks.
Congress paid off, workers laid off. Stanford, AIG, and Madoff. Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets and empty shops. And bank walking is AAA. Grandpa loses 401k.
Well, Nancy Carver, that's the voice of Bernard Madoff. That's the theme song from my film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. We're now running a campaign, what we call the Jail Out campaign, trying to get people to sign a petition to try to press the government to prosecute these Wall Street criminals and wrongdoers. And it's very consistent in a way with the work that you're doing. I want to welcome you on News Dissector Radio. We're having to shorten the show a little bit today, but you're involved with a project called Good Grief America, more about the people, our dignity, and our future than about our homes. Our homes were just the vehicles that Wall Street used to suck the life out of the planet. So this is where we start. So, Nancy, tell me more about this, about Good Grief America, and about your work, as well as your new ebook, Foreclosure Toolkit.
Well, that's a three-hour discussion, but we'll see if we can put some bullets in here that are of value for your listeners. We started because we found ourselves, my husband and myself, in this mess of foreclosure, and the bank wouldn't work with us. In fact, they told us, you need to get 90 days late for us to help, at which point, when we finally did it, they threw us in foreclosure. We have been 21 months pushing back on them, and we're getting ready to file a suit. And so we started with homeowners in our region of Southern Oregon, a small group of homeowners, and all of us are still in our homes 2 years later. Pushing back on this situation, we now have hundreds of homeowners across the state now spreading out throughout the nation that are staying in their homes with a little knowledge and support. This situation we're dealing with is criminal. The banks got huge bailouts for the mess they created, and with a promise that they would work with us and help us, and they aren't. And we've realized that this is a zero-sum game. It's all or nothing. And so we've decided that we need to play by the new rules. It's all or nothing.
Well, that's why I wanted you on the program, Nancy, because you are speaking out of a personal pain as well as a political stand. You are making a point that really needs to be heard, that people can be organized around these issues. I mean, one of the problems that I've noticed is that many homeowners sort of blame themselves for this situation, not aware of how calculated all of this was, how this premeditation in targeting certain groups of people to get them into homes they couldn't afford was done and engineered with the support of at least three industries, you know, real estate, finance, and insurance. And it seems that in striking back here, you're also educating people about the real situation.
Yeah, our main emphasis is on education, support, and referral to services. We're building a large and strong attorney network that we can refer people to that are affordable. And first step, though, is get them back their dignity with some education. We have full-grown men who call me crying and talking about suicide. And it's not just about their home. It's about the entire financial collapse they're in, and they feel powerless. They feel like that they're not worth anything anymore because they can't provide for their families. And our first goal is to help them get a grip and realize that they didn't do this. They could not have orchestrated this.
See, this personal dimension is often missing in the reporting, you know, which is about numbers. You know, foreclosures are up X percent, et cetera, and so forth. And, you know, the business news approach to all of this tends to side with the problems of the banks. You know, how are they going to straighten out this mortgage, quote, mess? It's never viewed in criminal terms, by and large, by our media. But it's experienced in criminal terms by the people who are being pushed out of their homes.
Yeah, it's horrific. And I've talked to and interviewed hundreds and hundreds of families from all walks of life. And what's interesting is all those people weren't talking together because it was divide and conquer, because of shame they weren't talking to their neighbors or friends about it. And yet their story is always the same. And so I am convinced this is organized crime. It was organized at the top at the beginning. And we do audit and research work for our homeowners, where we dig deep into the SEC, the EDGAR database, and find the crime. What we find is the trail that where the money came from is not the trail where the paper goes at all. And homeowners could not have done that. They could not have created it. They could not have thought it up.
How did you pick the name, Good Grief America?
Well, you know, we realize that America is going through a huge grief right now. And if you look at the five steps of grief, the first step is denial. And we are heavily in denial still. This nation is in denial about what we're undergoing and what happened to us and what is going to happen. Second step is anger. And we watch when people go from denial to anger, quite often they start to implode and go back into denial. And really, we need to go through all five stages of grief so that we can start getting to some resolution and to some proactive actions to start turning America back into what we thought we had, which was a free country.
We're going to be giving Nancy's contact information in a minute or two, so, you know, get a pencil out, because, you know, this is exactly what's been missing in all of this, the grassroots response, the people who are actually part of the problem, helping to solve the problem and demanding change in the problem. I've had some dealings with various organizations, and I've been impressed by the scale, you know, just the sheer scale of the number of people who are in this situation. It's massive. It's a catastrophe. And yet somehow it's minimized in the media. You know, the International Monetary Fund, Nancy, came up with a study basically linking foreclosure to growing unemployment and seeing a connection between the two that really the media has avoided, if you will. You know, foreclosure gets into the problem of individuals. The individuals maybe, you know, were scamming somehow, is the implication that they're responsible for their situation. And there's no kind of larger institutional analysis.
Who plan this?
Yeah.
We're so tired of the deadbeat term. In fact, We get our people get attacked by their neighbors. You know, the neighbors are in denial about what's going on. You're just a deadbeat. You deserve to lose your home. You bought more than you could afford. When in fact, 85% of our homeowners we're dealing with in Oregon are small business owners who had been long-term business owners, successful business owners, people who'd paid on their mortgages for many years, that now find themselves, because of this economic disaster, you know, not able to sustain their homes. And that ties in with unemployment, but it's kind of a secret shadow behind unemployment, because these people can't even go get unemployment insurance. They were business owners.
So there you go. I mean, incredibly complicated and at the same time extremely simple. Large numbers of people, fellow citizens, Americans mostly, but, you know, people who have come here in this situation, you know, trapped by debt, trapped by constantly getting phone calls in the middle of the night, being driven really crazy, sleepless, having tremendous psychological issues because of all of this. It's not just a simple, you know, political issue. And the administration seems like it's been mostly asleep at the switch, because the property rights of the banks seem to come before the human rights of the homeowners.
Well, yeah, and the banks are being rewarded. They are the predators that continue to be rewarded. And what we watch, you talk about the emotional distress, we watch a form of PTSD. You know, I'm looking at what's going on with homeowners, including ourselves, because we feel it. We're getting ready to file our case. I know how it feels to go through these steps. It is a form of financial terrorism that is worse than, I think, anything that, you know, Al-Qaeda could have done to us. We have got people pitted against each other in our communities over this matter, and just this terror that people can't even talk about what's going on with them.
Remember, the Tea Party was created, you know, by the CNBC, you know, quote, traitor correspondent, whatever he is, Rick Santelli, you know, who basically issued this appeal to people. Do you want to pay for your neighbor's extra bathroom? You know, just play to this resentment and, you know, this idea that other people have something that you don't have. Just instead of encouraging people to work together to solve these problems, basically to pit neighbor against neighbor. And we've seen this in many communities. The problem here, of course, is that the people who are condemning their neighbors are also going to be affected also, because when one house goes into foreclosure, the other loses value.
It means nobody in the community will ever be able to sell their homes. Between the dirty titles and the lowered values, everyone is losing. In fact, at our meetings, we decided to take a stance of being political neutral, because we have people from all walks of life that come to our meetings and our classes. And so I don't allow the political banter. We just have this nightmare going on in the middle of a class. And what we've found is, over a period of time, as people settle down and get their stability and their dignity back, we're finding people from the right and the left befriending each other as neighbors and working together.
Yeah, shared problems. I mean, again, I mean, my whole argument here is this is not a right-left problem. It's a right-wrong problem. We have a situation where very powerful institutions deliberately took advantage of people in order to profit, and profit they have, and the consequence is that the rest of us are being left, you know, with the detritus of all of this, trapped in situations that we can't possibly manage or get out of, in terrible pain, and nobody's listening, and that's why we have to work together and act together. And this is, I think, part of the inspiration of Good Grief America out there in Oregon, to try to demonstrate that this can be done and is being done. And that's why, Nancy, I really wanted you on the air to show some support for what you're doing, because I'm so impressed with it.
Well, thank you so much, you know, for your kind words. It is a huge job. We're doing it with, you know, a ragtag group of volunteers. We're getting very organized. We have legislation we're working on in our state. We have got legislators from the right and the left working together on the matter. And we've got a lot of attorneys coming in and getting the training. We're also doing attorney training on what went on behind the curtain and how to read this audit and research work and how to put it into a case.
Nancy, last night at the Rainbow Push Coalition with Reverend Jackson in Atlanta, they brought up the topic of moral hazard, you know, with where the people now, you can't even get a job because your FICO score has gone down because of the situation with this. Do you address the moral hazard of the banks?
Yeah, well, it's a big issue for us, because the banks got bailed out. And to me, that was the biggest moral hazard that happened, in that, you know, they say these deadbeats are trying to get a free home, and because of that, we can't let that happen or we'll set a standard, and that's the moral hazard. Well, we're saying we're not trying to get a free home. We're trying to keep some pretender lender who has no claim on our home, who has no investment in our home, from getting a free home.
There you go. It's not just about the bailouts. We need a jail out, in my opinion, of these people. That's why we're doing this petition. You can sign it at newsdissector.com/blog. We're trying to work on this issue. Nancy, we want to feature your work in what we're doing to the degree that we can. We know you've shown plunder in Oregon. We need your help to get this message out, and we want to do what we can to work together, because this is not just an Oregon problem. It's a national problem. It's a global problem, really. And that's why I wanted you to be part of this program. How do people reach you?
We've got a phone number they can call that goes into a voicemail, and then somebody gets back to them usually within 24 hours. It's 541-690-8334. And they can also go onto our online community, and it's www.goodgriefamerica.ning.com. Goodgriefamerica.ning.com.
There you go. And the number again, just one last time.
541-690-8334. 1-800-273-3334.
Thank you again, Nancy, for joining us, the organization Good Grief America, people who are doing work that all of us need to be doing, and I'm really proud to have you as part of the show. I mentioned earlier, this is not just a local issue in Oregon. It's not even just a national issue. It's a global issue, and the world's economies, the countries got together in South Korea, don't seem to have been able to solve any of our problems. In fact, the American proposals were rejected. To tell us more about this is an economist and someone who works in the finance industry, who I respect a great deal, Max Wolf. Max, what's your take on the front page stories today about the rejection of the Geithner-Summers-Obama initiative?
Well, first, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to join you. And second, I think that it looks like a miss on two fronts on this trip. So our G20 hopes were fairly dim going into this, as the U.S. initial proposals about 5-6 weeks ago were met with a fairly loud round of rejections. About a little over a week ago, week and 2 days ago, we had a quantitative easing round come out of the Federal Reserve, which was a decision to buy $600 billion more of U.S. Treasury securities to push down interest rates yet further and provide more stimulation to the economy because of the high and persistently high unemployment level. This was met with even less popularity, so we were fairly unpopular and rancor was high going into the G20 meeting. But President Obama's trip to South Korea had two basic agenda items. One was to finally ink and resolve a free trade deal with South Korea, and the other was to come out of the G20 with the best and most hopeful series of agreements among the G20 leaders, the other 19 leaders. And he seems to be headed home today, or is headed home now, with a very weak and somewhat disappointing round of consensus agreements out of the G20 and no trade agreement with South Korea to bring to Congress. So all things being equal, this trip will not go down as a high point.
So what does this mean? Does it mean that international agreement on, you know, regulation of these institutions, new rules for the financial order, is sort of impossible to achieve, perhaps largely because the United States doesn't want to play ball with the rest of the world, or is it, you know, just objectively not possible?
I think there were some agreements. Actually, I know there were some agreements on bank capital minimum requirement regulations, and there have been relatively higher agreements on new financial regulations. The real big breakdown in the G20 of late, and particularly highlighted the last few days, is that there are deficit countries and surplus countries. The United States runs a large deficit, as does the UK and a few other countries. And there are large surplus countries, it's sort of led by Germany and China, who have persistent, very large trade surpluses. They sell the world much more than they buy from the world. On the other side of the deficit states, like the US, who buy much more from the world than they sell to the world. The United States had sort of been pushing the notion that the wealthier countries, the ones with more funds right now, take responsibility for rebalancing this fundamental imbalance where some countries are huge persistent importers, net importers like the U.S., other countries are huge persistent net exporters, think Germany and China. And the United States is in a position of relative weakness. So I think it is important for people, particularly people, progressive folks who are used to thinking the United States is behind everything and always at fault. The United States is being bullied too and has fallen some in its international powers here. And so the United States is now in the position of being bullied by countries with more money at the present moment, just like we were in a position of doing that bullying most of the last 50 years. So these roles aren't American roles or Chinese roles or Brazilian roles or German roles. They're really roles of, you know, whoever's waving the rules is whoever's ruling the waves. And right now, the United States is not ruling the global waves internationally, so we're not able to wave the rules and force our agenda on other countries with anywhere near the ease that many people associate with past experience.
No, I think it's very hard for a lot of Americans to adjust to this new reality, to accept, you know, that we don't have the power, you know, to tell others what to do and, you know, to prevail in our conflicts and wars, you know, basically to set, you know, the rules of the game. And as a consequence, I think you have a resurgent right wing that will play to this idea that America has been weakened by the Democrats, weakened, you know, by China. All those ads in the campaign attacking China, you know, suggests that, you know, that there's a lot of not only parochialism here, but, you know, a sense somehow that we have these enemies and we have to be prepared to battle with them.
Sure. I mean, I understand that there's lots of xenophobia and baiting in the United States, but part of the reason Americans feel insecure and frightened of the world is because our place in the world is sinking, and most Americans' lives are highly insecure, increasingly tenuous. They have less money than they need, and they're nervous about the future that they have and the future of their children and the future of their grandchildren. Those nervousnesses, that feeling of insecurity, that's based in an absolutely reasonable assessment of the reality. Where we usually run into trouble, or at least where folks tend to take turns that I can't follow them down those paths, would be when they decide it's a foreign conspiracy or a liberal conspiracy or a Democratic Party conspiracy. That's sort of picking out the same old enemies and being frightened that the world's changed, and then withdrawing to the same old rules where the big fights for the United States were somehow internal because there was no external enemy. And while I don't think there's an enemy, we have significant external competition. We've lost millions of jobs. We've lost a significant amount of prosperity. We've mortgaged our future, and in some extent, we've mortgaged our future to foreign debt holders. And that means a different world. I mean, the United States is still a very powerful country, still the single largest economy, still by far the world's largest military. So, I mean, the United States is not exactly becoming a tiny, vulnerable target of bullying by any stretch of the imagination. But the sort of unipolar world with the American colossus, economic and military and diplomatic, sitting astride a unipolar world is very much not the situation at the present time.
What do you say to the people on the right and the left who basically say it's all the Federal Reserve Bank's fault, we've got to somehow audit the Fed or collapse the Fed or destroy the Fed, that this is the enemy in our ranks?
Right. I mean, I understand that there's a lot of heat on the Federal Reserve. This seems to happen every 10 or 12 years, particularly when there's an economic crisis. People ignore the Fed, which is very important most of the time, and then they succumb to strange theories that the Fed can solve every problem and is wonderful and magical, or is behind everything that's ever gone wrong, including their cousin Tony's athlete's foot. Right? I would call these people Fedophobes and Fedophiles. So this is usually based on some kind of weird conspiracy theory. The Fed releases lots of information. It could be more transparent, should be more open, but it releases most of the information people think it's hiding pretty much every Thursday when it releases its balance sheet, which is every Thursday of every week. So it's not quite as good of a conspiracy theory as some people think. And the history of the anger at the Federal Reserve often comes from free market voices that think any government intervention in the economy is terrible, gold bugs, and anti-Semites who believe that the Federal Reserve is a Jewish conspiracy. And that problem about the Federal Reserve being a Jewish New York banking conspiracy has been a popular theory ebbing and flowing in American history for at least 100, really 90 plus, almost 100 years since the start of the Federal Reserve or the Federal Reserve Act. So is the Federal Reserve very important? Yes. Should people be paying attention to it? Yes. Was the Federal Reserve the single most aggressive player in bailing out the financial sector of the United States? Yes. Is the Federal Reserve something to constantly watch with huge influence? Yes. Does the Federal Reserve run the U.S. economy? No. Does it run the global economy? No. Is it a conspiracy? No. Is it designed to undermine small farmers? That was one theory at one point. Prop up railroads.
Well, what about this whole quantitative easing thing where supposedly the dollar is being downgraded?
Yeah, well, if you buy a lot of bonds, if you buy any kind of bonds, particularly U.S. government bonds, bonds have a sort of inverse relationship. There's an inverse relationship between bond prices and yields, or the interest rate. So the more you pay for a bond, the less that the fixed return on the bond you get represents in percentage terms. You can think of bond prices and interest rates as two sides of a seesaw. If one goes up, the other goes down. So if the Federal Reserve announces in a plan, which the jargon name is quantitative easing, that it's going to buy $600 billion more worth of U.S. government debt, what they're saying is they're going to push the price of these things up by buying $600 billion more of them, and therefore the interest rate on them down. This is an action the Federal Reserve does to try to push more money into the economy, to push up prices and economic activity, and to push down interest rates on things like home mortgages, where home mortgage interest rates are directly linked to the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond.
Forgive me, Professor. We're unable to really do the whole story here of the Fed, but I appreciate your response. You certainly have given us a lot to chew on here and a lot to sort of, in a sense, respond to some of the simplistic theories about the Fed. Max Wolf, I really appreciate your joining us at the last minute here to be on the program. I am going to be away for 2 weeks. I'm traveling, and I'll let you know where I am and what I'm doing when I get there. In the meantime, you can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. You can listen to the music of Plunder and read more about the film at plunderthecrimeofourtime.com. And you can also be part of the blog, Dissector Blog Experience at newsdissector.com/blog. That's my information. And I thank you so much for joining us today as we move on into another week here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Stay tuned for Gary Noll. Oh, we've had Gary Noll. Sorry, but he'll be back.
One of the most important parts of a reform agenda is to encourage people to own something, to own their own home. Government must stand on the side of people. Because I understand if you own something, you have a vital stake.
I heard my dad saying we might lose our home.
My home.
3 million families now are said to be in danger of foreclosure. That's a 50-state Katrina. What started as manipulations and maneuvers on Wall Street has now moved to Main Street.
The cascading impact of the subprime mess is clear. No mortgage relief plan can undo the loose practices of the real estate bubble.
What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. And that holds true. Foreclosures have skyrocketed.
Not because they've lost their jobs. Not because of life circumstances. But because the mortgage is pushing them into foreclosure. Never has it happened before. People have the same income, the same job, but are losing their home.
The meltdown of the subprime mortgage market. How can I make this work for me?
They all displace themselves in our communities and rip people off.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this.
Making it that we can't afford to live in our own state. You know, well,